Thank you, Curtis. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Steve Lee. I'm an alcoholic. And Ken, man, I know how you feel, buddy. That's happened to me a number of times here with that Zoom. I was speaking at a meeting just about 10 days ago, and just right when I had them in tears and just about to pass the basket, it booted me out. And I'm not convinced whether that was a technical problem or whether the host just ushered me out of the meeting. But so we'll see if you guys let me stay the full hour here. I hope so, because I'm glad to be here. And it's been so great. You know, I look down, there are 32 of us here, right? And all that's important to me right now is that there be 32 when this is over. If I see one go down, that I'll be crushed. I'll try to figure out what I said that made you leave. There'll be no consoling me if there's not at least 32 people here at the end of this hour. And somebody said earlier today that some of you got your video screens off, and you know, some of you should, by the way. I've seen some things on Zoom no man should see this last year, but I invite you to turn your video on if you're just sitting there, because it does help me connect with you better, and feels like that we're both present here. You know, when Zoom first started, or when I first started participating with Zoom back in March of last year, and I was still very uncertain about how to use this platform, and Christine and I were talking before the meeting started, trying to figure out how many people are on here. And as you can see, I've become very acutely aware of where that participants number is. But at the first meeting I was speaking at, it was a group out of New York, and they had it capped at 1,000. Now I'm just watching that participants number, and they were coming in. There were 400, there were 500, there were 700, and I was speaking. And as that number grew, I began to speak more loudly so the people in the back could hear. And it had not dawned on me at that time that we are all on the virtual front row. So that's kind of cool. That's one of the pluses, right? It's no matter how many of us are here, it's really just kind of a conversation. So I hope for the next, 45 minutes or so, we just have a little conversation. And it's really not a conversation, is it? It's a monologue, not a dialogue, for the next 45 minutes. But then we'll see what happens. But I've so enjoyed listening to Sydney and Chris this morning. And most of you, most of this committed group has been here most of the morning. So that's kind of, it sort of feels like you're binge watching Netflix right now, I know. And you're on this third or fourth episode, and you wonder why should I, I thought this was going somewhere, and there seems to be no end to this story. And but what dawned on me as I listened to Sydney and Chris, and both of them said things which is comforting to me, said things that I hope I will say myself in some form or fashion. It will be personal to my experience, confirms that identification, that the experiences, not always about the way we drank. All right, guys, can you hear me now, guys?
Yes, we can.
I'm on my iPad now. Now, unfortunately, this isn't a slathering a camera angle as you would have had, and so it's you're not going to get the same visual effect that I would normally hope to present, but we will just see what happens. However, you are in a position to see all of my chins at one time, so that's a rare angle for most of them. Anyway, I apologize for that, and that's but I was just saying, I think that how much I enjoyed listening to Sydney and Chris, and again, how they've said things that I hope to say, but will say based on my experience, right? Personalized, but that's around the identification that we have. That's really where that begins to happen. And I think the point that Chris made for me, that's not always about, oh, I drank and got in trouble. There's some comfort in that, right? There's some comfort for me to know that you
that you drank and that you had some alcohol-related problems. But it is particularly comforting for me when I find out that we often have the same feelings, that that unmanageability, those things that I couldn't even articulate before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys would say something about how you felt, and the moment you said it, I would know that has been true about me forever. And the moment before you said it, I wouldn't have been able to describe. You know, there's a great line in A Vision for You talking about Dr. Bob, and it says, he was painfully aware of being somehow abnormal, for he did not yet fully understand what it meant to be alcoholic. And I can't tell you how much time I spent painfully aware of being somehow abnormal, yet I could not have told you what was abnormal. You know, we all hear so many people talking about feeling different, feeling on the outside looking in, or however many of us describe that feeling. And then if you said, well, Steve, you know, how do you feel? And I go, I don't know. I just know it's different than I think you feel. And that sense of separation that Chuck Chamberlain talked so much about, right? That single problem that we all share, not necessarily even as alcoholics, but as human beings, is that conscious separation from man and God. And the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, once I move the alcohol off to the side, are designed to remove those things that block me off from the sunlight of the Spirit, that connect me to that power, that allow me to connect with you. It becomes, and so it changes the nature of how I experience the world. But, you know, my sobriety date's June 30th of 1989, and I can tell you on June the 29th of 1989, I wasn't having any of these thoughts. Right. Anything I share with you today about my alcoholism and even how I felt about it is primarily through the rearview mirror. It's primarily with the context of looking back from today's point of view. So I'm gonna try to do some of those things and share with you. But just so much about what both Chris and Sydney talked about resonated with me. I know Chris made a point, you know. A salient point that is true for me, that I don't want to confuse meeting attendance with my recovery. My recovery will typically be accompanied by pretty good meeting attendance. But those things, but the attendance itself at a meeting is not evidence of my recovery. I sometimes hear people say, maybe you do, that I go to meetings to see what happens to those that don't go to meetings. And I will tell you, that's not my, I go to meetings to find out what does happen for those that go to meetings. I come to AA not looking for the problem. I'm attracted to what, I'm not here today. I'm 31 years between drinks. And let me be clear about this. I am capable of another drink. I'm not confused about that. But I'm not here today out of fear of taking a drink. I'm here today because I'm so drawn to and excited by the life that I have today and where I'm going. I am headed toward the light, not running from the flame. And that's a huge change. That happened somewhere in the first year I was sober, and it's grown, right? Someday that I didn't even know when it happened, when I wasn't even paying attention, I changed from a guy that can't drink to a guy that doesn't drink. And I changed from a guy that has to go to AA to a guy that gets to go to AA. And I can't tell you the exact day it happened, but I can tell you that's how I arrived here today. I'm a volunteer here today, but I got to Alcoholics Anonymous under the lash of alcohol. I got here, like Chris said, like all of us got here at one point. I show up at Alcoholics Anonymous at the level of the problem, but I stay at Alcoholics Anonymous at the level of the solution. You know, my wife and I'm going to go back and start my story. Here's what you already know, and Billy, you already knew it because you wouldn't have invited me if you hadn't paid enough attention over the years. I'm going to do my best to do what you invited me to do, tell you a little bit about what I was like and what happened, what I'm like now, but I just don't pretend to do it in any particular order. You know, my story is like a Quentin Tarantino movie. There's no time and space continuum. And If I think of something, I'm going to talk about it, and I'll hope by the end of the hour it has made some sense, and if not, it doesn't matter. I'm going to go on about my day, and y'all will too, but I will have done my best. You know, I got off a talk one day, and I called my sponsor. This was years ago, and I was living in Richmond, Virginia at the time. I'm in Nashville now, but I said, Joe, I just don't think I did a very good job. I just gave a terrible talk. And he said, Steve, that implies there's a time you think you gave a good talk. He says, so you're starting from a false premise. And he said, look, it's not up to you to give a good or a bad talk. He said, hell, they invited you. He said, you just go do the best you can on any given day. And you don't have any idea what's a good talk or a bad talk or what's useful or what's not. That just, you know, those things are going to land where they land, and God's going to use them how he uses them. So I'm just going to do the best I can. But I told you my sobriety date's June the 30th of 1989. And for me, that means the last time I had a drink or a drug was June the 29th of 1989. And I was about 6 months sober, went to my sponsor, Frank, and I said, Frank, I'm confused about this sobriety date. Is it the last day I had a drink or the first day I didn't have one? And he said, Steve, I'm just so impressed with the quality of questions that are keeping you up at night. He said, I don't care. He said, pick one. He said, I am much less concerned with when you had your last drink than you not taking the next one. And that's the way I have viewed it ever since. But I did, just pre-pandemic, I was at my home group, and it's a small little group, and so a new guy came in, or I didn't recognize him. And at the end of the meeting, I was chatting with him some, and I said, how long have you been sober? What's your sobriety date? And he said, my most recent one. And I said, yeah, let's start with the most recent one if we can. Now, I'm going to ask y'all to hold one quick second. I'm trying to make that connection even better because I don't want you to miss a word. anyway, on June the 29th, I was not intending to stop drinking. I had no plans to stop drinking. I always confirmed, you will now know that I didn't plan to stop drinking, because the last drink I've had was on that evening of June the 29th, was an after-dinner Amaretto on the rock. And nobody, no alcoholic worth his or her salt, would choose an Amaretto as their last drink. I will tell you, for 31 years I've been telling that story, there is no AA street cred in Amaretto. You can't impress anybody. That's not a tough guy story. It's humiliating. But it's the truth. And what I'm committed to doing here today and every day that I have the chance to talk in Alcoholics Anonymous is be honest. Because I used to have a much more exciting story. It was not true, but it was exciting. And I also found, though, that it wasn't very useful. And see, the things that we have, that I know that I bring to Alcoholics Anonymous that is of primary value is the truth about me. Now, I don't know who it's going to be valuable to. I know my story doesn't resonate with everyone. That's why you've had at least three speakers on here today. Our stories may land different places with different people. And that's why ultimately we all tell our stories, right? That's what we do in AA. We talk. We tell our stories to one another. We share our experience. Both Chris and Sydney talked about the importance. Sydney walked us through her experience with the steps. Chris emphasized over and over the importance of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, of being engaged in that recovery, of finding the directions in that big book. So that's what we talk about. But what we talk about, see, you've had three different, if this was a restaurant, Chris and Sydney and I are frankly all the same dish. You know, you got steak with each of us, but there are different spices and a different marinade in each of those dishes. At its core, it's the same. But we bring our own experience and our own description to that process. And that's what our 12 steps says we do, right? It says that having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. So what is the message that I have to carry? I got one message to carry, and it's that I've had a spiritual experience, and it was the result of these steps. That's the experience that I have. Let me ask you guys, are you able to hear me? Because I continue to see some freezing up on my end. Okay.
Hearing you fine, Steve.
Okay. Well, just wave at me if I fade out, or just do this. If you just say, just stop anyway, there's nothing useful happening here. And, I've got my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. We got this wonderful thing. We got this book that, and what happens to me when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, the book of Alcoholics Anonymous and your stories confirmed my experience. And I will tell you that today my experience begins to confirm the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I get to share with you, I show up and you say, Steve, here is this design for living. Here are these 12 spiritual principles that you want to embrace and following are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of action. And you say, if you'll take it, this is what we did. And what you did with me was you shared with me your experience. You said, this is what I did and here's how I did it. That's what a sponsor kind of does, right? He says, I'll show you how I did. Sydney talked about, which I love, how she takes her sponsees. She does what was done with her, and she doesn't know another way to do it because that's what she's done. I'll share with you that, and trust me, I'm not trying to make a big point beyond the fact my sponsor, I don't pray on my knees. I'm not an on my knees prayer ticket. I'm not an anti-get-on-your-knees guy. I'm just being honest that I don't typically pray on my knees. My sponsor says he doesn't know how to stay sober not praying on his knees because he's never not prayed on his knees. And he's afraid not to not pray on his knees because that's worked for him. You know what I'm saying? He's not telling me what to do, but he says, Steve, this is what I've done. My wife is in the other room. I'll talk about Connie more in a minute. Connie's a sobriety date is just 10 days after mine, and she's likewise 31 years sober. Her big book wore out. And Chris, I tried to get her to let Myers, bind that old book together. But she bought a new book, but she went through her old book, and she wrote down everything she had in there exactly as it was, exactly the same place as when her sponsor took her through that 31 years ago. And me, I get a new big book about every 2 or 3 years, so I'm not trapped by what I wrote in it before. So two different points of view that are working marvelously for both of us. And that's what I want to say. The program doesn't change, but our experience with it might be slightly different. You know, you can pick up a guitar and play the guitar, and it's still a guitar no matter how we play it, but different people have different styles. So that's some of the room we've got in AA, but at the core, those 12 steps are what we do, and they're designed to do one thing for me. They're just designed to connect me to a power greater than myself, which will solve my problem. As Sydney says, I'm not in the problem-solving business. I'm in the connecting with God business. Right. And that's what our steps do. But anyway, on the reason that I took had that amaretto on June the 29th, because I was scheduled into a treatment facility on July the 1st of 1989, and scheduled is the right term, right? I had been convicted of my 6th DUI a year before as a result of a plea bargain agreement. They gave me some jail time and they cut some of that jail time off if I would go to what they described as residential drug and alcohol rehabilitation. Now, I'll tell you, in 1989, I had never heard all those words strung together at one time. I didn't quite know what it meant. I wasn't sure what that was going to be. It sounded marginally better than jail. So I said, I will comply with the terms of this plea bargain agreement. My wife and I went and went out with some friends on June the 29th. It wasn't particularly raucous evening. We came in and I had an amaretto, smoked a joint, went to bed. Got up the next day. We spent that day with our daughter, Abby, who was 5 years old at the time. And then on July the 1st, my buddy Ricky came by to pick me up to drive me off to this treatment facility just 7 or 8 miles from where I was living. And Connie walked out with me as I was getting ready to leave. And this is often where some of my AA brothers and sisters tear up, because Connie's last words to me as I'm headed off to treatment were, "No matter what, baby, don't stop drinking. I don't know what you're going to be doing over there, but just go do your time." See, now, Connie was not trying to get me to stop drinking. I had met Connie. We had been married 7 years at the time, and we had met just over 7 years before. We'd met in a bar in Nashville. Connie had just come back from Lake Tahoe, where she had been a baccarat dealer in a casino. She had just gotten divorced, and she had a pocket full of divorce money and a divorce pickup truck and a divorce 8-ball of cocaine. And I fell head over heels for her. That was the package I could not resist. And we started running together. And a few months later, we went on a trip to Mexico. And we drank some tequila out of a coconut. I don't know why it was in the coconut. But next thing I know, we are on a boat going out to what they swear were international waters. And an Austrian merchant marine read in Spanish what he swears was a wedding ceremony. Now, Connie and I don't speak Spanish, so we're not sure what we agreed to on that boat. I can promise you the love, honor, and obey apparently were not included in that particular ceremony because she has not complied with that in the ensuing 38 years. But I will tell you, when she said that morning, she meant it. She said, "No matter what, baby, don't stop drinking." Because, see, she wasn't trying to get me to quit drinking. She wanted me to drink with her. She wanted me to not drink where I was and with some of the people I was drinking with. She would prefer that I acted differently, that I was a better husband, that I was a better father. But she wasn't trying to quit drinking. Heck, she wanted to control and enjoy my drinking. She was just unable to execute that efficiently. So I head off, right? And as I said, Connie's sobriety date is 10 days after mine. And what I want you to know is we did not talk in that 10 days. She meant what she said, but she had an experience that is her story to talk about that 10 days later, she decided that she was through drinking. And then she went 4 years without a drink before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she's got that story to tell. But today you're getting my story. And my buddy Ricky drives me off there to this treatment facility. And I walk in and immediately they decided to examine my relationship with alcohol. You know, that's what you folks in AA encouraged me to do, to examine my relationship with alcohol. That's a pretty critical piece of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they did it in what they call an assessment. It felt like a test to me. Now, today, assessments are a little more clinical in nature. They are designed for a variety of things to help determine level of care, to help determine how to code insurance billing, a whole host of things that are appropriate, useful, and fine. But the assessment they gave me that day, while it had some of those components, it had 30 questions that were a little bit like Jeff Foxworthy's "You Might Be a Redneck If." And 30 questions that began with the phrase, have you ever, which they explained meant even once and even with a really good reason, have you ever drank in the morning? Have you ever drank alone? Have you ever had a DUI? Have you ever had a blackout? Have you ever had trouble at work because of drinking? Have you ever had trouble at home because of drinking? 30, have you ever questions that, as you guys know, just have check yes or check no to what I contend are clearly essay questions? These are questions that beg for an explanation. And you know, there are a few smiles on here today because you get it, right? I mean, you understand. And what I want to say is there was nothing funny that morning when I was in there. I could not make myself check the box because how can you do, you're going to draw conclusions about me. You're going to make judgments about me based on how I check this box, yes or no. And how can you do that without the backstory, without context, without an explanation? And I know today just how easy it is to do that, but that day I didn't. And part of my problem is I think I know what they're asking. I mean, I had questions about the questions. I said, be more precise. What do you mean morning? Because what I think they're asking me, if I'm that guy that's got to come to at 4 a.m. with a half pint on the nightstand and take a pull off of it to fight off the sweats and the shakes and just stumble into my day. And I've done that a few times, but not so often I'm going to check it on this test. But I thought, what if I'm out somewhere at a very nice establishment at 2 or 3 a.m. at last call? Is that morning drinking? And if I don't explain the difference to you, you'll think I'm pitiful half pint on the nightstand alcoholic rather than cool out at the club alcoholic. And to be honest, I was never cool out at the club alcoholic. I was old guy hanging out at the club way too long alcoholic. But see, I think I know what they're asking. They said, have you ever drank alone? I went, yes, but they left. You know, we started together. Did you ever just look around and go, whoa, where did everybody go? Because, see, again, I think I know what they're asking me. I think they're asking me if I'm that guy that's got to go home and close and lock the door, pull the shades, dim the lights. Used to be unplug the phone, but now just put the phone on silent or vibrate and drink and hide and isolate from the world and drink out of fear of facing what's out there. And did I do that some? Boy, you can bet I did, but I'm not checking it on this test. But there's another kind of alone drinking that I did. I'm a guy that had to drink to go drinking, right? I'm a guy that had to drink to go to the club. I got a drink to go to the party. I got a drink to go to the family dinner. I got a drink to go hang out with my buddies. I got to drink before. I've got to have I think it was Sydney that talked about that, pour alcohol on top of that restlessness, that irritability, that discontentedness, that hyper self-consciousness that I don't know is the root of my problem. I got no idea that I got alcoholism when I'm not drinking. That makes no sense to me at all when I first get to you. See, and our book talks about alcohol in one place as a social lubricant. And man, I needed to be socially lubricated. It's like oiling up and then I can move easily amongst you. And without that, I feel like the ball in the pinball machine, right? I'm bumping into you. I'm full of fits and starts. That's the way I felt sober out in the world. But I will tell you, I did not look that way. I don't believe anybody in my life would have described me as insecure, as afraid, as lonely, which I will talk about a little later. And unsure because I acted like a guy with stone sober. I know what it's like to stand in front of the door and get ready to walk through that door. And then be the dancing bear once I get through that door to act like a guy would act if he were comfortable, if he were personable, if he were outgoing, if he were gregarious. I want to act like a guy would act. If he felt the way I pretended to feel. And what I will tell you, what I've discovered is that acting is hard work. That kind of act is exhausting. And I spent a great deal of my life acting like that, trying to My job was to not let you see how I feel. And I didn't know it. I didn't understand it that way. It's not like, I couldn't articulate the feelings I had until I got to AA. You guys gave voice to my alcoholism. You guys began, to, as I said, to talk, and that's that identification. I go, that's it. And pretty soon I began to be able to give voice to the feelings I had been unable to articulate. And there are those feelings that both Sydney and Chris talked about in the bedevilment, right? There are those feelings of an inability to control my emotional nature, prey to misery and depression, can't be of real use to other people, bouts of fear, feelings of uselessness. And I wouldn't have been able to label them, but I know once I saw them that I had some mixture of those feelings most of the time when I was sober. And I don't know that I was consciously pouring alcohol on top of those feelings, but I do know that when I drank, I felt better. I felt more at ease and comfortable in the world. And so I didn't do too well on that test. But what I know and what the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous helped me see right away is how I answered the questions on that assessment isn't what makes me alcoholic. Those are the type of questions that might be a red flag, that might expose alcoholism, that might shine a light on the problem. But you helped me see what I was finally able to embrace is my relationship with alcohol. That when I honestly want to, I can't stop entirely. And when I drink, I have little control over the amount I take. Now, I didn't see that. I was about 3 weeks into this treatment experience when I began to be able to look at that and at least at some level recognize that that was true about me. Because see, before, and it was great news, you know, in the doctor's opinion, when Bill writes that the doctor's theory that we have an allergy interests us, it explains that for which we could not otherwise account. That idea that I had an allergy was interesting to me. It actually revolutionized my point of view about myself. It didn't give me an excuse, but it gave me an explanation for what happened. Because see, back in the chapter to the employer, now I know I'm with some committed AA members here today, but you got to be full on committed AA member to read all the way through to the employer. And in to the employer, it says when dealing with an alcoholic, there may be a natural annoyance that someone could be so weak, stupid, and irresponsible. See, now that's coming from the perspective of the employer who is uninformed about alcoholism. And I will tell you, to the untrained eye, alcoholism looks weak, stupid, and irresponsible. To the untrained eye, it looks like if you loved me, you wouldn't do that. It looks like if you cared about this job, you wouldn't do that. If you loved your daughter, you wouldn't do that. If you wanted to stay out of jail, you wouldn't do that. It looks like some circumstances might be sufficient for me to straighten up and fly right. Right? Chris talked about that today. He talked about looking for that external solution. The job, the relationship, there's something that'll make me okay. And I'm going to move into that into a minute. But this is my relationship with alcohol, that when I took a few drinks, I felt more at ease, but it had bad side effects for me. I'm a get in the car and go somewhere kind of drunk, and that's a bad plan for a guy like me. And as I said, I totaled 6 automobiles. I had 6 DUIs. In 1980, I was leaving Atlanta, Georgia. I was living in Atlanta, Georgia. I'd been at a bar one afternoon throwing back kamikaze shooters and taking Tylenols. And I left there disoriented. I went east in the westbound lane of the interstate. I hit a car head on. 2 other cars hit us. It totaled all 4 cars. It sent some people to the hospital. I came to in the Cobb County Jail. I'd urinated on myself and I vomited on myself. I hope I did, because somebody did. And if you're in the drunk tank, it is not always, if you pass out. You just never know what the stains you wake up with may or may not be of your own making. But I found myself there that morning, and I had the experience that Sydney talked about this morning. I sat in that jail cell, and I think Chris spoke about it as well when he talked about that experience where he came home and said he was done. And I sat in that jail cell that morning in 1980. I'd never been as afraid of the consequences that awaited me legally, personally, professionally. I'd never been as ashamed of what I'd done and the harm I'd caused other people. I had never been more humiliated at the state I found myself in that drunk tank on that Saturday morning in my own urine and in my own vomit. And I had never been more certain that I'll never drink again. I quit. I quit for good that morning. And 10 days later, I'm driving down the road, smoking a joint, drinking a bottle of wine, thinking I nearly overreacted to that. And as Sydney referenced this morning, so when I found in our book in the and Sydney, I'm just impressed. You're the first speaker that I've heard that had to clarify that it was the English speaking version of the big book. So that just impressed me no end already. But so it must on the English speaking version, it's on page 24 that says there'll come a time that a guy like me, the alcoholic, won't be able to bring to consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago will be without defense against the drink. Now, I didn't see that till after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, but when I saw it, I could lay that back over my life experiences, and that certainly is what happened, that when a head-on collision buys me 10 days of sobriety, that seems to be the maximum measurable amount of physical sobriety that I get from a head-on collision. I don't want to test it anymore. So I got that relationship with alcohol when I did that plea bargain agreement, and they gave me both the jail time and go to treatment. They said, if you get arrested anywhere in this first year, you will go to jail for a year, Steve, if you get pulled over for any drug or alcohol related offense. Nothing frightened me more. So I made a decision to not drink for this year. I was walking to my car thinking about this new decision I'd made not to drink. And I kept thinking about it. And as I thought about it, my plan took on a revision. Really, the problem is drinking and driving. So I absolutely will not drink and drive for the year of this probation. And I meant it. But I wasn't to my car yet. And I was still walking. And unfortunately, I was still thinking. And before I got to my car, my plan took on yet one more revision. And the new plan was I won't drink much when I drive. And I see you laughing, but the truth is, see, I don't know that I can't decide to only drink a little. I don't understand. I feel weak, stupid, and irresponsible. But I don't know that lack of power. I don't know that I got a physical allergy. I don't know that I got a mental obsession. None of that makes sense to me. It didn't feel powerless. It felt like I changed my mind. It felt like linear thinking. And it's a really good plan to try harder. It's a really good plan to do better. I spent a lot of time trying to do better, and I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys let me know pretty quickly, Steve, that looks like the right thing to do. You even look impressive. We see you breaking a sweat trying to do better. But see, that is me operating on self-will. That is me with even my best intentions and firm resolve trying to overpower my alcoholism with those good intentions. And you said it looks like the right thing to do, but you need to redirect your efforts. You need to redirect your efforts from trying to do better to trying to connect with this power, to trying to connect with a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem, which again is the solution that AA offers. So I was about 3 weeks into that treatment experience. I could tell you some more drinking stories, but I ran out of amaretta. I didn't have any more of that, and I don't want I won't bore you with more of the same. But what I will say is those things explain my relationship to alcohol. But Chris and Sydney really talked about, and this to me I think is critical, the second half of the first step, the unmanageability. I think the 12 steps feel like they treat the unmanageability in me, which makes drinking unnecessary. You know, that unmanageability is for me the bedevilment. It is that restlessness, that irritability, that discontentedness. I can't overcome those, but I can't read myself and educate myself out of that condition. You can't talk therapy me out of that condition. I keep thinking that I'll read one more. I got probably 30 spiritual books back here behind me, all read about 30 pages in. If you hadn't converted me by page 30, I'm getting a new book, you know, because I keep looking for the answer. And you guys keep prescribing action. See, I keep hoping still today I will unwittingly fall into the trap that a new piece of information is going to make the difference. And information is important. It's critical. But here in Alcoholics Anonymous, what you taught me is it's not the information. It's putting the information into application that brings about the transformation. Alcoholics Anonymous is a transformative program. It's not an academic exercise. And man, I'm on here with some people who love AA, I know, and there's some newer people on here too. Christine, I'm so thrilled that you're with us. And I will tell you that I'm a big book guy. You know, Chris was talking about that. And I've been in a lot of big book meetings and big book studies. And I love them. And they have helped me. But if I'm not careful, I will turn that into an exercise. Pretty soon I'll be parsing words to the point that I'm telling you what Bill meant to say. And we can get caught up in that versus having the spiritual experience that Alcoholics Anonymous is offering. What I want to do is take this information and then have an experience with it. I got about 15 minutes left. I'm trying to figure out the best way to use them. I told you I'd be all over the board, and hopefully you'll connect the dots later. But I came out of that treatment facility and I decided that I needed to not drink. And I was going to not drink. And since I had met many women in AA, you guys had brought meetings into us and we had gone out to meetings, and I was fascinated by the men and women that I was meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. You're an eclectic group. Even on here, I'm telling you, I can only see 20 people on my screen, but this could be an audience at the Jerry Springer show. I promise you that this is a fascinating group of people, right? And you've got interesting stories, and that's kind of cool. But I did not yet know what Alcoholics Anonymous was going to ask of me relative to my participation in my own recovery beyond the fellowship that you were offering. And the fellowship was critical, but it doesn't stand alone as the solution to my problem. So I'm going to not drink. I decided I'm going to not drink, but I will tell you, it was a sad day when I decided I was going to not drink, because I thought we were going to spend a lot of time not drinking in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought not drinking was an actual activity in Alcoholics Anonymous. We will get together and not drink. You know, would you look at Billy not drink up there, man? Look at the technique on him. We look at her, right, and just, whoa, look at her not drink. Unbelievable. And it'd be pitiful, and I'm prepared to do it. And life in AA was going to be all about where I can't go and what I can't do and who I can't hang out with. It was going to be a life of self-sacrifice. And my life was about to get really small. And the truth is, I couldn't see how small my life had become. I can't tell you the number of places I could not or would not go back to. The number of relationships that had splintered off and stopped, the number of people that didn't want to spend time with me, and the number of people I did not want to spend time with. I had a very small little nuclear group that had become my world, and I couldn't even see it. It's amazing that folks like me, maybe not you, I shouldn't put you in it, but that given everything alcohol did to me, the idea of putting it down seemed like a sacrifice. And it seems like a sacrifice in the same way. It's an abusive relationship. And I make light of no one who has been or may be, unfortunately, in some sort of abusive relationship. But when I'm watching that bad movie of the week on TV, right, and he or she is about to go back to him or her in that abusive relationship, and I'm going, don't go. Don't do it. This is going to end badly. And it always does on that TV movie of the week. But when I put alcohol down, it's the same type of experience. I break up with alcohol. And then about a week later, I get a alcohol booty call. Yeah, an alcohol comes and says, hey, Steve, let me come over. Just let me come over, man. We'll just cuddle. We'll just hang out together. It'll be like old times. And I say, okay, come on. And we have a couple of good dates, and then alcohol beats the hell out of me again, right? And yet I was in that vicious cycle for years, but unable to see it. I think that Sydney spoke about it. I can't differentiate the true from the false. My alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I'm sitting here today looking through the rearview mirror and going, how could I have ever normalized that behavior? How could that have ever looked normal to me? But I couldn't imagine another way. And seeing, and as our book used to be, it was one of the titles considered was The Way Out. You folks showed me the way out, not just the way out of my alcoholism, but the way out of the insanity that didn't allow me to see things as they really are, to see the world as it is, and maybe most importantly, to see me as I am. Now I got an hour's worth of stuff to say in 10 minutes, and I don't know how to edit that, so I'll just screech to a halt at 12:30, what the hell. But I will tell you that it is, I fell in love with that. I got a sponsor. I went down just 2 weeks ago. I got to go back to the little club where I got sober. It's here in town, but they just started having some in-person meetings outside. And for the first time in over a year, I got to give a little talk to a group outside. And man, it was wonderful. And it made me think about all of the people that have been part of my recovery for the last 31 years. And a lot of them started right over there at the 202 club here in Nashville. But so I fell in love with AA, with the men and women of AA. And then I began to fall in love with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor took me through the steps. I don't have time to navigate that territory with you. I'm going to ask you for a minute to believe that I took those actions so I can talk about the benefits of those actions a little bit. Because that's what Chris talked about toward the end of his talk, right? We don't scare you in here, and we don't scare you sober. I think in the long run, what got me was I was attracted. If you've decided you want what we have and have decided you'll go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. We don't say if you're trying to avoid what we did. Now, I will say in the forward to the first edition, it says we hope that these stories will prove so convincing that no further authentication need be necessary. So we tell you some information about ourselves so to hopefully then attract you so you don't have to prove it anymore. Let's move on toward the solution. And the solution in Alcoholics Anonymous is one thing. And it is finding that power. There may be other solutions. But our book says that each of us in our own language and from his own point of view talks about how he established a relationship with God. That's what we do. And there's nothing, if AA doesn't say there aren't other solutions to alcoholism, but it's just the only one we got. That's what we're, step two describes the solution to my problem. And the rest of the steps are how I access that solution. And I just go through the process of these steps. But I had a problem when I got to AA. That day that I decided that I had that relationship with alcohol, that I don't seem to be able to stay stopped and I can't control how much I take. And I said, well, and the book says, if so, you're probably alcoholic. And I said, well, sounds like I'm alcoholic. I'm guilty. The next line in the book was the most disappointing day in Alcoholics Anonymous for me. Because if I'm alcoholic, it says you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience can conquer. And I said, oh, damn, I got a problem. I got a problem I can't solve. You got a solution I'm not interested in and I don't believe in. I got a solution I don't think's available to me. And then it calls it a dilemma, right? Our book describes that as a dilemma. I was 18 years sober before I looked up the word dilemma. A dilemma is a problem with two equally unacceptable solutions. I do not want to die an alcoholic death, and I did not want to live life on a spiritual basis. I want door number three. I do not want to accept spiritual help, and I do not want to go on to the bitter end. These are the two choices that were given in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was not excited about either choice, primarily because I did not believe that a power greater than myself, I didn't believe in it. Certainly not, I didn't actively believe in it. And I didn't believe that there was such a power that I could access it. I'm a guy for the first several months sober, wouldn't hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer in our meetings. I would step back from the circle. And I want to tell you how grateful I am that you told me that was okay. I have that freedom, and you gave me the freedom to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous to learn what Alcoholics Anonymous was. You didn't make me learn the rules of the game before I came to play. I get to grow up in AA. I went through my big book, and everywhere it said spiritual experience or spiritual awakening, I blacked that out with a marker. And my sponsor, I used to say I did that with my sponsor's approval. And he said, no, he said, Steve, but you did it with my knowledge, but not my approval. And, but what he had done was taken me back to Appendix 2 in our book, Spiritual Experience. And he had helped me find language that was more accessible to me. It helped me find language like a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. And so everywhere I had blacked out spiritual experience or spiritual awakening, I wrote personality change above it. And I was willing to have a personality change before I was willing to have a spiritual experience. And he said, Steve, you're struggling with language. He said, I don't care what you call it. I want you to have the experience. A rose by any other name would smell as sweet. See, that I get to, he just wanted me to have an experience, and I was all hung up on the labels that I and others were attaching to that. I wouldn't use the word God because I didn't want you to think I meant what you meant when you said God. I took a stand in places that didn't deserve a stand, but I didn't understand it. So you gave me the room. I am going to close on time, so I'm short-circuiting some of this, but it is a critical piece for me of my recovery. That piece where Alcoholics Anonymous moved from an informational self-help program to a spiritually based spiritual solution to a spiritual malady. It is my belief that the first half of the first step describes my relationship to alcohol. But I think Chris talked about it when he said Silkworth even told us, we don't get to blame everything on our alcoholism. I don't get to go around and trip over life and say, well, I'm out, you know, that's my alcoholic mind. No, that's bull. But the 12 steps, I think the second half of the first step, the unmanageability, the first half of the first step is exclusive to the alcoholic. You got to be alcoholic to have that allergy. But the second half of the first step is common to the alcoholic, but not exclusive to the alcoholic. Unmanageability is part of 200 other 12-step programs. And those feelings of that inability to control my emotional nature, that hyper self-centeredness, that discomfort. You know, our book says we alcoholics are sensitive people. I was sober several years before I realized that's not a compliment. I should know it's not a compliment because the next line refers to it as a devastating weakness. It is a devastating weakness, devastating handicap. I'm handicapped by this hypersensitivity that is expressed another way is self-centered fear, which is the root of my trouble. And this spiritual solution is aimed at that self-centered fear. And I am trying to move through the process of the 12 steps from self-centeredness to God-centeredness, from self-consciousness to God-consciousness, from egocentric to God-centered. And I will tell you that I vacillate back and forth from those positions all day long, every day, because I am never going to be perfect. I'm always going to be somewhere on the scale. So I'm having all this resistance to God. I wouldn't say the word God. And then I heard a story that many of you have probably heard. It was about the blind men and the elephant. And it says, there were three men from Hindustan to learning much inclined. They went to see an elephant, but all of them were blind. One of them grabbed the elephant by the tail. One of them grabbed the elephant around its big leg. And the other one grabbed the elephant by its trunk. And they went back to their village. And the villager says, tell us about an elephant. They had never seen an elephant. Tell us about the elephant. And the one who grabbed the elephant by the tail described it as being rope-like. And the one who grabbed it around its big leg said it was like a column. And the one who grabbed it by the trunk said it was snake-like. And they argued endlessly about what an elephant was, never understanding that the elephant was big enough to have all of those traits, and that they weren't describing the elephant. They were describing their touch point to the elephant. They were describing their relationship to this elephant. And what that means for me today is when I hear these varying descriptions of our higher powers, and that I'm no longer put off by the differences. I'm no longer threatened by them. I'm perfectly comfortable to recognize that God is big enough to incorporate all those experiences. And when our big book says that no one can fully define or comprehend that power, which is God, what a blessing that is to me to know that none of us has the whole picture. What we have is a description of our relationship with this higher power. And then it says that the fundamental idea of God is deep within every man, woman, and child. So I have adopted the idea that that's where God is for me, deep within. And God is deep within each one of you from my point of view. And if that's the case, then that's something we all share. And that becomes my connection point with the human race, where I felt disconnected. That's my shared experience with you. And the book says, as I draw near to him, he will disclose himself to me. Since God is deep within every one of you, the way I draw near to him is to draw near to you. You guys invited me in here today, much to your chagrin. You have been polite for most of an hour and pretended to listen while I babble on. And what happens for me in that exchange is this power shows up in a way that I can't define or comprehend. But it's made it unnecessary for me to take a drink since June the 29th of 1989. And for the most of that time, when I'm willing to accept the gift, it's given me a life that's happily and usefully whole. And I believe the reason that it's happy is because it's useful. And I also believe that that's the reason that it's whole. There was a man that lived here in Nashville named Mo Hollering when I got sober. And Mo wasn't my sponsor, but he was one of the huge influences on my recovery. And Mo was that guy, and you got him in your home group. When you go sit down in that meeting, and you hope that man or woman shows up, right? Man, I hope he's here today. Because when they walk in the room, you can take a deep breath. That was so most of when I was newly sober and a much younger man, and life was spinning out of control, and I didn't know what I was going to do, and I didn't know what sobriety was going to look like. He would walk in the room, and I could take a breath. Because his comportment, everything about the way that he conducted himself, said, this is a man with a solution. And it wasn't what he said, though he said wonderful things. What I know now, it wasn't Mo that I was attracted to at all. It was the clear channel and the God within him that I was attracted to. But Mo always ended his talks with the verse to a poem. And when he got cancer in 2003 and was close to passing away, I went and had breakfast. My friend Jerry and I did. And I asked Mo, I said, Mo, would you mind if when I get a chance to share my story, I end with that poem? because it so succinctly describes my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was a little embarrassed, you know. He said, "Oh, Steve, if you think it'll help another drunk," because that's the kind of AA member he was. And I said, "Mo, it'll help me honor you. And in the truest sense of AA, it'll help me pass on what you passed on to me and so many others." And Mo passed away 6 weeks later. But I've never shared any version of this story because it's a different version every time. But it has in the last 18 years since October of 2003, I've never ended without the burst of that poem. That's something you can count on. And it's helped another drunk every single time. Because I'm the drunk that it helps. He said, "I sought my God, and my God I could not see. I sought my soul eluded me. But I sought my fellow man and found all three." Again, that's what you've done for me today by inviting me in here, by you guys hanging out with me. And I have found my fellow man, and I found a connection to a power that I can't describe or comprehend. But I'm awfully grateful for it. Billy, thank you for the invitation. Folks, thank you so much for listening to me.